and gentlemen, before we go any further, I would just like to inform you that Scientology, Scientologist, Dianetics, and the name L. Ron Hubbard are registered trademarks owned exclusively by the Church of Scientology. Thank you. Now let's get on with the show.
Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone and Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
When we attacked your planet, all your soldiers and all their advanced technology could only put up a measly 9-minute fight before they were exterminated. Which is why man is an endangered species.
Welcome to the Projection Booth. I'm your host, Mike White. Joining me again is Mr. L. Rob St. Mary.
Well, I just happen to have my E-meter right here, so let's fire this baby up.
All right, get your thetans in gear. This is the second of two episodes we're doing related to Scientology on film, or in film, or about film, or something like that. This week, we're looking at Battlefield Earth, a saga of the year 3000. Despite the title, this movie was released in the year 2000. Directed by Roger Christian, this film was based on the doorstep of a novel by L. Ron Hubbard. The film roughly adapts the first 406 pages or so of Hubbard's 1,000-page opus and tells the story of Johnny Good Boy Tyler, one of the last surviving members of the human race. Man is an endangered species after the systematic destruction of the human race by the Cyclos, a race of giant, cold-hearted beasts who have systematically destroyed countless of thousands of worlds in their quest for economic domination of the universe. Rob, I gotta say, when you brought up Battlefield Earth for our show, I was gleeful in anticipation and subsequently dreading the experience of watching this movie for a second time. Like tens of other people across the country, I saw Battlefield Earth at the theater, but you missed having that pleasure, sir.
That's correct, sir. I have not seen this film until this episode, and I gotta say, I'm sorry. The reason, once again, if you haven't listened to the previous episode where we talked about Makaban Mu and several other films related to L. Ron Hubbard, was that I had read the book, Going Clear by Lawrence Wright. And after I read the book, I became fascinated with all of this interconnection between Jack Parsons, the occult, L. Ron Hubbard, Scientology, which you can hear in the previous episode. And out of that, I said, well, why not do the next logical extension, which is Battlefield Earth, because it's the only film that's based on one of L. Ron Hubbard's books. Because for years, it's my understanding, and based on the book that I read, Going Clear, he had tried for several years to write scripts in Hollywood in the 40s and 50s. Had no luck. Nobody wanted to buy his work. And nobody really wanted to adapt any of his books up until Battlefield Earth was ready to go and come to the screen.
Battlefield Earth, released in the early 80s. One of the last things that he wrote, I believe, he did like a 10-part series of books before that. I mean, the guy has written years and years and years and years and done hundreds of stories and all these books and stuff. And Battlefield Earth was the first one that I read, which I guess was showing the success of the movie and kind of played right into producer John Travolta's hands there. I did exactly what he wanted me to do, which was to read some L. Ron Hubbard work.
I think when we look at that, though, is the reason why Hubbard was not adapted, and I have read a few pieces of his short fiction, isn't that it's not bad. It's that I think because he became so entrenched in creating Scientology, that nobody wanted to get near it. That's probably the main reason why his books were never adapted. When he was coming out of the same lineage, he was friends with Heinlein, he was friends with Harlan Ellison, he was friends with, I don't know if he's friends with, but he was definitely in the same era as Philip K. Dick. So all of these science fiction writers who came out of the pulp magazines, a lot of their stuff has gone onto the screen, except for L. Ron Hubbard.
I don't know if anybody could be friends with Harlan Ellison, really.
Well, it's funny that you bring up, you reference Harlan Ellison. There was a piece that I read, and I should have mentioned this in the last episode, in Skeptic magazine, where Harlan Ellison said that Scientology was all a scam because Hubbard said that he was going to create a religion during a meeting of sci-fi writers that he happened to be at.
Yeah, I once read that it was based on a bar bet between him and Heinlein, and he was just like, you know, I'm getting paid pennies a word. The real money is in religion, so why don't we go ahead and start this religion and, you know, see who can do it better. So I guess the text for Heinlein was like a stranger in a strange land, and I don't know. I mean, we're still using the word grok today, but otherwise, I don't really see a whole lot of people following that book like people follow Dianetics.
Getting back to the idea of L. Ron Hubbard and his sci-fi writing, let's talk a little bit about the plot on this thing, Battlefield Earth. What do we got, sir?
Okay, yeah. Well, I actually listened to this book. I didn't read it. I listened to, hours and hours and hours. The entire trip I took to Chicago, I listened to it there and back. I mean, the audiobook, the unabridged audiobook, has to run, I don't know how many days. And then I ran out, like, the for some reason, right around the 110th chapter for it, it kind of crapped out on me. So I had to switch over to an abridged version, which was read by Roddy McDowell. And that moves stuff along a lot faster, really kind of moves stuff along that really didn't need to take that much time. I have to say, Battlefield Earth, the book, is really kind of an overwritten book. There are just a lot of stuff going on and a lot of stuff getting explained in great detail that might not necessarily need that much.
Well, consider, I mean, at the time when Hubbard came up, he's getting paid by the word. So maybe that carried with him.
It could be, because 1,000 pages really didn't need to necessarily be that long. The story, in a nutshell, is the whole idea that man has been taken over. It is the year 3000, allegedly, even though nobody really has a good count of how many years ago stuff was. Man is basically kind of reverted back to this, I don't want to say caveman, but in the movie, you really kind of get this caveman sense to them. It's almost a little Planet of the Apes-ish that you have this superior race. In that case, it's ape, and they're dominating man, and there are just a few pockets left. In the book, there are just a few pockets left of humanity all over the Earth. And you get to see some of the ones in Africa and Scotland and China and all this, because people have kind of moved to the mountains, especially into radiated areas, because the cyclos do not breathe air. They breathe this special gas, which we never really learn what it is. It's called breathe gas. And that reacts poorly to radiation. So
it's actually called breathe gas?
It's called breathe gas is what they call it.
You know, I think L. Ron Hubbard may have influenced James Cameron. Unobtainium, I think, may have been an L. Ron Hubbard idea as well, because that's one of the dumbest names. It's called breathe gas. What? Come on.
Yeah, you couldn't take 5 minutes to come up with a better name than unobtainium? Really? Come on. You spent how much money and time making Avatar and you couldn't come up with something better? Yeah. So yeah, breathe gas.
Yes.
Yes, good stuff. So yeah, it's reactive to radiation, so there are certain places where cyclos can't go. And of course, if you shoot a cyclo with a radiated bullet, they're going to go up like a, you know, Roman candle, because they've got all the breathe gas in their lungs and bloodstream and everything. Yeah, and in the book, the cyclos are described really as being very bony. Like, they talk about how they have eye bones. They don't have eyebrows. They have eye bones. And for some reason, they swear by saying the word crap a lot. Yeah, it's just kind of weird. And there's this whole thing of, like, Johnny coming down from the mountain and getting captured by Turl, the main alien, who's played by John Travolta in the movie, and this whole like training of the man animals into mining. And it isn't until quite a bit later until they go over to Scotland, of all places, grab a whole bunch of Scottish guys, take them back over to the United States and over in the Denver area, train these guys to mine stuff, and secretly Johnny is training them all to learn how to speak Cyclo and teaching them all this kind of stuff that he learned from this learning machine that kind of shot information into his head. Yeah, again, it's like you spend a lot of time on this stuff. This whole thing takes forever. And finally, they decide that they're going to take out the Cyclos with radiation. They have to find radiation. That takes us up to like page 406, where they shoot a bomb up to Cyclo and it destroys the planet, even though they don't know until like page 800 that Cyclo has been destroyed. Oh, help me out, Rob. This book kind of did some damage to me when I listened to it.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. I really didn't mean to do that. I mean, to me, let's get into a couple things. First off, let's talk about the films and then read the book. Flyovers in the beginning, I go, hey, that looks like Colorado. And then I was confirmed as right, because there's a sign about 40-something minutes in that says, welcome to Aspen. What is it with my hometown coming up, or my new hometown coming up? But anyway, so they're all living in the mountains, and I agree with you. It's almost like caveman versus spaceman kind of thing that's going on. And to me, the design of the Cyclos, I mean, it's my understanding that when the film came out, I read some coverage about the book, and they said that they were supposed to be tall. They were supposed to be like 9-10 feet tall. They were like twice the size of the average person. And obviously they couldn't do that. So there's all these Dutch angles in the film. But in terms of the design of the Cyclos, this is what I thought of. Rasta Nazi Klingon linebackers. That's basically what they look like to me. They all have dreads. They have certain level of dress that makes them look like Nazis. Their headpiece kind of looks like they're Klingons. And they have these big-ass shoulder pads that make them look like linebackers. So Rasta Nazi Klingon linebackers have taken over the human race, put them into bondage, and is forcing them to mine for gold within the mountains in the film. And the whole thing is they need to get the gold, right? So they're not going to do it. They're going to get the humans to do it. It just brought up certain things to me as I was watching it that I was like, you know, is he trying to make a Nazi connection in the story? Do you see that?
I didn't necessarily see the Nazi angle to it. So where are you seeing this at? I'm very curious.
Well, there's certain design concepts that are very severe. It could even be Soviet, you know, just really kind of blocky, severe kind of stuff. But to me, the allusion to the Nazis, okay, they've been under the control of the Cyclos for 1,000 years. Well, Hitler always talked about the 1,000-year Reich, right? And also the idea that they put them into work camps, to put the humans into work camps, and that the Cyclos are genocidal. They want to kill the human race off. So there's this whole sort of, okay, work camps, killing off the human race, genocide, and 1,000-year Reich.
Okay, yeah, I can kind of see that. And they have killed off other races completely. The race that teaches Johnny via the learning machine, in the book they're called the Chinkos, and in the movie they're called the Klinkos. But it's kind of funny because if you watch it with the closed captions on, they still say Chinko in the closed captions. I'm not sure if that's supposed to be a reference to Chinese people or what, but yeah, it's kind of like Chinkos. That's kind of a weird name.
What about Plinko? Do they play Plinko?
Maybe the Chinkos play Plinko.
Come on down.
Yeah, so I guess I can kind of see that. And yeah, I guess it's different too, because in the book there's not really like a work camp kind of thing. There's like Johnny in a cage for a long time, and then at one point when he has his guys, they're like living in bunkers out in a different part. You know, I guess there's this whole idea of like NORAD being in Colorado, and they kind of talk about that, but not really. Like, one of the things that's a lot different about the book too is that everything is pretty much disintegrated. It takes a lot for them to find stuff, salvage stuff that is still usable 1,000 years later. In the movie, not so much. They go out, they, you know, find Harrier jets that are just absolutely fine. But there's no Harrier jets in the book. They do fly some stuff, but they're flying Cyclo things. So I guess it's a lot easier to tell the Cyclo ships from Harrier jets in the movie, and that's probably why they did that. But yeah, it's much different world, and the Cyclos are a lot smarter in the book. They have already taken all the gold from Fort Knox and all of the reserves and everything, even though Johnny finds some gold coins in one of the banks in Denver, so you'd think they would have found that. But they have really taken all of the loose materials that they need and just are kind of, you know, mining everything else.
And that was the thing with the mining. I don't know if it was ever really totally explained why they need all this gold. I mean, they don't wear it like Mr. T. I mean, I think that would be one more aspect that would be nice. You know, Rasta Nazi Klingon linebackers dressed like Mr. T. But I can't really quite remember exactly what the hell they want all the gold for unless they just wanted to want it.
Yeah, they don't really explain it in the book either. That just seems to be their method of economic domination, is that they mine a lot and they have the ability to teleport things. And they seem to be the only group of all the planets that has teleportation, and that's how they get the materials from Earth back to Cyclo. And they don't even say that they're necessarily mining gold in the book. They just, that's the most precious thing. So when Turl sees that there's a vein of it that has been exposed from a rock slide up in this radioactive mountain area, that's when he gets the bright idea of, okay, I'm gonna get this man animal to mine it for me. Which is, you know, a pretty outrageous idea, because they basically treat men like less than monkey kind of stuff, you know. And there's all these like little like jokey things in the movie that aren't in the book. Like this whole idea of like, oh, well, dogs are the superior race because men would clean up their poop and stuff. And it's like, yeah, where did that come from? You know, it's not in the screenplay. So it's like, where did that happen? So the screenplay was actually pretty straightforward adaptation, ended in the same place, started at the same place, followed a lot of the same through lines. But yeah, just weird stuff that they kind of added along the way. This whole like thing of the man kind of making these like caveman noises and monkey noises and stuff, that wasn't necessarily in there. The whole thing of like piece of cake, I don't get why they all say piece of cake and they yell piece of cake all the time.
You know, you want to talk about, and obviously I haven't had the opportunity, and I use that in quotes, to listen / read the book or the screenplay. There's a monologue about 26 minutes in that John Travolta gives. He's drinking like this radiator fluid looking stuff. Oh, it's cringeworthy. It makes you almost go, Tarantino did you a big favor, and this is what you do, is you shoot it in the foot 5 years later.
I can assure you that I was not groomed since birth to have some cushy job that even a moron like you could perform. While you were still learning how to spell your name, I was being trained to conquer galaxies. To do anything less is a disgrace to my entire family life.
You know, there's a lot of stuff, and we'll talk about this after the interviews that we play back. There's a lot of things that went wrong with this movie, and I have to say John Travolta's performance is probably one of the biggest things.
But that's the problem, is, you know, he's connected into the film so deeply on several different levels that there would be no way that you could go, you know, we really want to make this movie, but not with you. In a way, you got to feel for the director, because it was like he was, you know, he knew going in that this was a star vehicle and this person's attached and they're going to do what they're going to do. And there's really probably not a lot that he could do to make it better.
Yeah. Yeah. That he was producer and star. The first thing that the producer should have done was say, get that Travolta guy out of there. But yeah, this was his vanity project. He wanted this, man. This was his thing. All right, we're going to take a break and play back a pair of interviews. The first with screenwriter J.D. Shapiro and the second with director Roger Christian.
Hi there, I'm a Gumbo, and I'm with the Traumatic Cinematic Show. We're a podcast that talks about films. Yeah, we'd like to invite you to come listen to our show. You can find us at traumaticcinematic.com. You can also find us on Twitter at DC Podcast Crew. Also, you should come over and check out our Podomatic page, traumaticcinematic.podomatic.com. We're also on Facebook, so you can come on out there and find us too. I'm on the internet.
Hi, my name's Chris, and I've got Steven Seagal on the Old Dog and Bone. Steven.
Yes?
Have you ever desired to hear a weekly movie podcast hosted by two fellows from the northeast of England who run their little hands through the week's movie news and then cap it off with a review or two, ranging from all sorts of genres, kung fu, anime, straight-to-video tomfoolery, bit of horror?
No.
Well, you're a dick who doesn't know what he's talking about. I don't even know why I'm asking you. I'm sure there's other people out there who have a desire to hear such a thing. So if you're one of those lovely people, pop on over to wafufm.com. That's wafufm.com and check out the show. You can also find us on iTunes, Talkshow, and Facebook at facebook.com/wafublog. Wafu FM, it's a podcast that's good and stuff. Shut up, Steven.
Everyone wants to spice things up in the bedroom. Here's an offer you won't want to miss. Listeners of the Projection Booth podcast can enjoy 50% off just about any one item at adamandeve.com when you use the promotion code BOOTH. You also get free shipping and 3 free adult DVDs. Once again, that promotional code is BOOTH. That's B-O-O-T-H. Visit adamandeve.com today.
Howdy, folks. You like blood, violence, freaks and nature?
Then you come to the right place. My name is Gary, and I'm your guide to Cinema Beef Podcast. Every episode, we not only deliver film reviews, we also dismantle some of your favorite and most hated films, sometimes for the better and sometimes for the worse.
Hey, you shut your face! If we want to hear you talk, I will shove my arm up your ass and work your mouth like a puppet.
All right, calm down. Every show I hope to have a new co-host, podcasters, and listeners alike. That's right, I'm talking to you people. I take all comers.
You're slats.
That's not very nice. The only rules, well, let's ask the best cooler in the business.
All you have to do is follow 3 simple rules. 1, never underestimate your opponent. Expect the unexpected. 2, take it outside. Never start anything inside the bar unless it's absolutely necessary. 3, be nice.
So join the insanity and please vent your frustrations. I'm available on TalkShoe, iTunes, and Stitcher Smart Radio. And remember, here at the Cinema Beef Podcast, if you got beef, I've got the grinder.
How did you get involved with the project?
So I was dating this girl and we became friends. And then I met her sister at a party and she was talking about Celebrity Center. And I didn't know what Celebrity Center was. And she explained to me it was the hub of Scientology in Los Angeles. And I gave her the Groucho Marx line, which was I wouldn't be a member of any club that would have me. And then about 6 months later, I saw this article in Premiere Magazine that was pretty much trashing Scientology, but one of the Scientologists or ex-Scientologists said Celebrity Center was a great place to go meet women and get laid. So I thought, all right. So I called her up. I said, hey, let's go to Celebrity Center. So went down there, and it turned out the president was a big fan of Robin Hood Men in Tights, and we ended up talking for a while. And then she told me about, you know, she started pitching me L. Ron Hubbard to do a movie on. And I said, I'm not a documentary filmmaker. It's not something I want to do at this time. And she's like, no. He wrote a lot of Pulp Fiction books, which I wasn't aware of at the time. And I went, oh, I figured, all right, let me hear what he has. So I had a meeting with a bunch of people at a place called Arthur Services, which is their book division. And there was a few books that sounded intriguing. I read them, and one of them was called Fear. And so Fear was the one that I liked the most. And when I called up, they said, oh, that's something John Travolta's been wanting to do for a while. So John and I ended up meeting. I gave him my take on Fear, which he liked a lot. And I set that up at Miramax. And then after I wrote the first draft of Fear, John called up and wanted me to do Battlefield Earth. And I said, oh, let me read the book. And he's like, don't you want to just do it? And I was like, no, I got to read the book and see if I'm capable of doing it. And he's like, but it's sci-fi. You love sci-fi. I said, yeah, let me read the book. So I read the book, and I felt there was some really good stuff in the book that could translate to a movie. I also felt there was really bad stuff in the book. But there was enough there that I thought could make a really good movie. That was how it all came to be.
When you read it, what was your first impressions when you read the book?
My first impression was, I think more than one writer wrote it because it seemed to be a bit uneven to me. But I thought, I do love sci-fi and I love the whole underdog aspect of it. And so I thought, okay, this could be a really cool kind of like Planet of the Apes, Braveheart type movie. and which is the way I pitched it to MGM. That's how I saw the story taking place. My script is extremely different than what was ended up on the screen.
How did you kind of approach it? Did you say, like, I'm going to do the whole thing, or you're just going to take certain aspects of it? What was your creative process like when you came to, you know, adapting this, or did you just kind of throw it out the window and say, this is what I'm going to do?
First of all, no, I knew I couldn't do the whole thing. Pretty much any book, you couldn't translate the whole thing to a film. It would be anywhere from, you know, 4 hours on, and this was a massive book. So I started to think, okay, what were the aspects? What was the basic theme that I liked of the book? And what are the aspects of the book that I want to tell? And so then I kind of own it. At that point, it becomes my story. I know I need to service the book and do justice to what I think works. But by doing justice, you also have to get rid of things that don't work and reinvent things to make what I liked work. And so that's when I started to own it. And I didn't just use the book. I actually also sat down and watched, because with the Imperial regime, I actually ended up sitting down and watching like a week's worth of documentaries on the Nazi regime and the takeover in Germany and how that came to be, because I saw a parallel between the two. And like I said, anyone who was unfortunate enough to see the movie would be like, what's he talking about? Because none of that's in the movie.
Well, it's funny that you say that, because my podcast partner brought up Nazism, and I was like, I don't see that at all, but something must have kind of trickled through to his subconscious from that aspect of it.
I'm not sure how he picked that up, because I looked at it and was like, oh, God, this is awful, but maybe there was a little bit left over. I mean, maybe just the suppression and the way everything was controlling and the way that they looked as humans, as non-human. But yeah, my script was much, much edgier, much darker, much more epic. And that's how the book was an epic piece. And I just thought that the story deserved even more, even to be elevated more than that, which is why I watched all those documentaries. And then I watched Braveheart again, and I watched the original Planet of the Apes again, because I did see a parallel, and those are two movies that I really liked a lot, which I'll do. That's another thing I do. My process also is, before I write a script, I'll sit down and watch a movie that I love in the genre, and I'll break down that movie. I literally sit there with my computer, and let's say I start the movie at 3 o'clock. I'll write like, okay, 3:02 this happened, 3:03 this happened, 3:06 this happened. And it gives me a rhythm and a feeling of how a good movie works.
Now, was this your first adaptation?
No. I'm trying to think what my first one was. It was definitely my second, because Fear was based on a novella. So that was my first full. I think there was one before that. But no, it wasn't the first adaptation. First adaptation of a book that was, you know, well over, I think, what was it, 1,300 pages?
Yeah, it's at least 1,000. I don't remember how many more north of that it is.
When I got it, I was like, I'm dyslexic. This is going to take me forever to read number one. I read it, and then I think I read it twice and also listened to it on audio tapes.
When it came to what was in yours versus what ended up on the screen, I don't want to, you know, bother you with minutiae and stuff, but what were some of the biggest changes that you saw, or what were some of the things that you were doing that, you know, kind of fell by the wayside?
Pretty much everything I feel like I did was gone. It's interesting. The way Writers Guild credit works is, because I was the original writer based on a novel, unless the new writer comes in and changes the sections that I took, or changes the characters, or changes the story, that it's almost impossible not to get writing credit. The one thing he did was he stuck with the sections of the book that I had originally wrote about. But pretty much everything else, from dialogue to, there was a lot of new things I added, hardly anything stayed other than the story structure that I brought in from the book. I certainly didn't have Turl wearing dreadlocks and looking like Kiss. In fact, I remember I went to see, I think it was Any Given Sunday, and the trailer for Battlefield Earth came up, and it was the first time I saw any of it, because I had been shooting, I'd been directing another movie, and I didn't have time to go see. Another Writers Guild rule is they have to show me sort of the process of editing, but I didn't have time. They don't have to listen to me, by the way, I just have to show it. And when I saw the trailer, I was just like, are you kidding me? Can I curse?
Yeah, feel free.
Okay. I was really like, what the f***? I kind of slid down in my seat just in case anyone would recognize me. Not that anyone would realize I wrote it at the movie theater, but, you know, my mind was like, I better fucking hide.
So once you wrote your draft out, what kind of happened to it then? What was the next step for you?
Right after I wrote my first draft, the next steps were pretty good. I got a phone call from John Travolta, flipping out over it, loving it. Invited, you know, you got to come to dinner tonight. What are you doing? I'm like, well, I already have plans. Well, can you break them? I said, no, not really. And then my girlfriend at the time was like, are you crazy? You got to go to the computer. Okay. So went to dinner with John, who, by the way, is the nicest guy in the world. And he just went on and on and on about how much he loved the script. And he actually said it's the Schindler's List of sci-fi, which, again, sounds a bit ridiculous considering what the movie turned out to be. But he tapped into it right away, and I didn't tell him, you know, and what I did after he said that, I was like, you know, oh, fuck, I was watching some stuff from Nacho Regime, blah, blah, blah. And so that was the first step. The next step was I ran into Mike Marcus, who was the president of MGM, and at a premiere for something, and he came up to me and he said, this script is terrific, we're all real excited, still needs a little bit of work, but we're really excited, which I agreed, it still needed a little bit of work, it was a first draft. And I said, all right, here we go. Then the next thing I know, I've got, you know, three big directors who are all interested in making the movie. And now normally at that point, what would happen is a deal would be made with the director, and then I would sit down with the director and hear what his thoughts are or her thoughts were. And then all of a sudden, I was away. I was in Palm Springs, and I get the notes from MGM. It's like a few weeks later after that or so. I get notes, and I'm like, what the fuck? Because 90% of the notes were just a lot. I mean, would kill the movie. So I call up Mike Marcus, and I'm like, is this a joke? He's like, no, it's not a joke. I'm like, come on, it's a joke. He's, no, why? I said, because you can tell them they're killing the movie. He's like, well, we stand by these. Actually, I said, where are these notes coming from? Well, they're coming from us. I'm like, yeah, where are they coming from? He's like, well, they're coming from John's camp. I said, okay, well, John's camp is the Church of Scientology. Not for nothing, you know, they're not filmmakers. I mean, if they're good notes, great, but this will kill the movie. So I had a couple more steps left in my contract. And but I said to Mike, I said, I'm not going to do it. I said, you know me well enough. I'll do 10% that work, and I'll make some other changes that need to be made, but I'm not going to do these notes. And I think that was on a Monday, and then Wednesday I got a phone call from my agent saying, you're fired.
What were some of the notes that they were coming back with?
You know, I wish I still had those notes. I don't remember. I mean, essentially what the film became, I guess, it was getting rid of things that really were essential to the story, adding things that made no sense. I don't remember if it said tone it down and make it less edgy. I don't really remember the specifics. I just remember my reaction to them.
You said that the notes were coming from the church. Could you see any kind of like agenda with them as far as like, you know, be more respectful to this or that kind of stuff? Or was it just like goofy ass shit that they were coming up with?
Goofy ass shit. My sources had the most slot, and you know, there were several. So this is, my understanding is that L. Ron Hubbard had written 200 pages of notes on how he wanted the movie to be. For some reason, this was never mentioned to me. Because I actually had a sit down, you know, before I wrote the script, I sat down with all the heads of, not all the heads, but like 10 people at Scientology. And I said, just understand, I figured this was never going to happen. And I said, just understand, once I start writing this, this becomes mine, which means I'm going to add stuff and I'm going to throw out stuff, but I got to hold it in order for it to work. And they're like, oh, yeah, no problem. Ron was a writer. We understand. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. But the notes that came back, so we didn't reflect that attitude. It was bad notes. Like a lot of people, I know a lot of people have this whole like, oh, it's a Scientology movie and they're trying to indoctrinate people and it's all about that. That was never the case with me, certainly, when I first started doing it. And it's up until the point that I was on it, even with the notes, that was never felt like the case. It just felt like it was really bad storytelling.
You said that you got fired off of the project. Was this one of your first times that you'd gotten canned?
Oh, no. That's not typical in Hollywood. I tend to be a little outspoken. I went to the studio head. That's fucking stupid, and I'm never going to do that. I've been fired before. This one, though, was at a stage where I, like I said, since we had directors that were interested, I thought, okay, great. But typically, it just it doesn't matter what level of writer you are. The studios are always looking for their what we call pencils to come in. And what I mean by pencils is it's like, you know, I'm the original writer of it, so, and I'm stubborn, so I have my ideas of it. If they bring in another writer, they're going to be more accepting of the studio's notes.
So what was the fallout when the movie came out? You said that you kind of crouched down in your seat, but once it finally was out there, what was it like?
Yeah, that was for the trailer. So before the movie came out, I read the shooting draft. I think I got 3 or 4 pages in when motherfucker and went to my gym in my house and just started punching me at a heavy band. And I think my words were, this piece of shit, what they're making. And I somehow plowed through the script, and it was just god-awful. I mean, just terrible. And I had meetings that week before the movie coming out. I had people saying to me, hey, you know, the movie's getting excited. I'm like, no, the movie's good tank. And they're like, come on, it's Travolta. And I said, it could be God. It doesn't matter. It's going to tank. I thought it would do, you know, $25 million. It didn't even do that. So the fallout was I started using a different name on scripts.
Did you think about taking your name off of this one?
I actually wanted to take my name off of it. And there's a Writers Guild rule, which someone's going to have to explain to me one day. If you get paid over a certain amount of money, I actually wanted to use a pseudonym. If you get paid over a certain amount of money, you can't because you're considered part of the marketing. Like, you know, then you have name value. I'm like, well, if that's the case, then shouldn't I get a percentage of the gross, not the net? So the rule is that you can't use a pseudonym. And if I had taken my name completely off the movie, which I wanted to do, there's a huge bonus, and then there's residuals that you don't get. And my attorney and agent at the time talked me out of it. They're like, don't worry, people in town know this draft isn't yours. It's your draft that got your vote to sign on. It's very different, blah, blah, blah. And I decided to keep my name on the script. I mean, on the movie.
Out of curiosity, what pseudonym would have you have used?
There were two that I was debating on. The one I was going with was Sir Knickknack.
You famously showed up for the Raspberry Awards to pick up your award. What was that like?
I had no idea what to expect. I didn't know if people were going to be like boomy or just like complacent or just not care. And it turned out to be a lot of fun. I lucked out, I guess, in a way, that it was the same year that Sandra Bullock was up for, I forget what movie she did. Which happened to be the same year she also was up for the Academy Award that she won. So it was packed. There was lots of press there. And they really, you know, I wrote what I felt was a funny speech, and luckily the audience felt the same way, and they couldn't have been more gracious, and it turned out to be a lot of fun, and Sandy gave a great speech as well, so it was actually a fun evening. A lot of people questioned me, like, why would I accept the award? I said, well, if you listen to the speech, I'm actually distancing myself.
Was there ever any kind of, you know, you said that you used different names on scripts after that. Was there a time where you said, okay, the dust is settled, I can go back to being J.D. Shapiro again?
What was funny is I immediately after it came out did some TV stuff. My agent was like, let's use Jake. So it's Jake Shapiro. And then I decided to go off the script and just use a completely different name. And it sold to Nuoid. And then after that, I was like, okay, fine. I think it's been long enough that I can go back to JD. Because, you know, I saw a script to Nuoid, which I had before, and then they're like, well, we just kind of, you know, my agents are like, well, we do have to tell you if you know the writer. Oh, we don't. Oh, yeah, you do. Oh, why did you change his name?
What kind of stuff have you been working on lately?
A few things. I guess the two main things are there's a project I'm doing with Stan Lee, who, if people don't know him, because sometimes I'll either get, oh my God, Stan Lee or Stan Lee who, from my mom originally. I'm doing a new superhero project Stan and I have been creating for a while. That one is a lot of fun. A lot of fun to be working with Stan's amazing. And then there's a script I'm waiting to see Warren Zide, who did all the American Pie movies, wants to produce it. So we're figuring out a strategy. It's actually a musical comedy. If you took Whiskey Business and American Pie and squished it together with Moulin Rouge and Grease, you'd have this movie. And so we're figuring out, you know, people to attach and then go to studios with it. And then there's a graphic novel. I actually co-wrote the graphic novel for the project I'm doing with Stan. And so there's a new graphic novel that I'm writing as well. So, I mean, I tend to just keep writing a lot.
Hopefully nobody in our audience would not know who Stan Lee is, but I really sincerely hope that. Didn't he just have a birthday recently? Didn't he just turn like 90 or something?
He just turned 90, and the man has more energy than like all of us combined. We went to an event, this is about a year ago, went to an event in Vegas, and then afterwards they invited us up to the Playboy Club. And Stan's like, Jakey, I'm going to stay like 10 minutes and then I'm going to bed. I'm like, all right, this is probably about 10 o'clock at night. At like, I don't know, 2, 3 in the morning, Stan's still there, having a good time. And then I'm like, Dad, I'm going to bed. All right, Jakey. You know, there's a lot of people you work with, and sometimes your heroes disappoint you, and Stan has certainly never disappointed. You know, it's just, I mean, yeah, talk about, like, I've been very, very lucky. There was a movie I did called We Married Margot, a little independent movie I wrote and directed, and George Lucas became a fan. So he invited me up to Skywalker and gave me free sound mix. And so to hang out with, you know, Lucas and pick his brain and learn things and have that opportunity. And then to be working side by side with Stan on this project as a partner with Stan on it is just, most people growing up thought I was going to end up better in jail. So, hey.
So, yeah, it sounds like you bounced back after the Battlefield Earth fiasco pretty darn good.
Yeah. Stan and I used to joke around about it. For some reason, he had a figurines from Battlefield Earth in one of the offices in his office suite. Luckily, there is life after Terrell.
Primarily talk to you about Battlefield Earth, but I was hoping I could ask you a few questions about your career. I mean, you've had such a wonderful and long career.
I've kind of always been fairly rebellious all the way through my career, and you know, coming from art school and getting into the film industry and being mentored by John Box, who really, to me, was one of the greatest designers ever. He designed Lawrence of Arabia and Dr. Zhivago. And the reason I came into the industry was Dr. Zhivago when I saw it. So to get a job as making his tea, to me, was kind of auspicious beginning. And he mentored me through to keep my own personality and not to become part of the kind of committee art departments that were prevalent then. And I think that prepared me for Star Wars when it came, because if that had been a conventional art department, this film would never have been made. John Barry, the designer, completely thought out of the box, and we had to just find ways to make this film with literally no money for a film like that. So I was able to kind of suggest to George, you know, I'd always had the idea of using scrap to create the interior of spaceships, because I thought then they'd look like real, like submarines, a cross between a submarine and a flying craft. And having directors who had faith to say, yes, try it. And I think both Ridley and George, it was all serendipity, you know, that moment in time. Those films came at a moment when no one really believed in science fiction before that. The films just didn't relate to audiences. And here they came, these two giants, really. So I was pretty, at the time, you know, you just get your head down. I didn't have a day off on either film when I worked 7 days a week. It just, you know, crashing asleep at night and getting up and going to the studio again. You don't really think about it. You just love what you're doing. And they somehow created a really enduring legacy.
I think the thing I like the most about Star Wars and Alien is that they both have that kind of dirty space feel, as opposed to something like 2001, where everything is so clean and neat.
Yeah, that, the first conversation I ever had with George in Mexico, he said, I'm trying to make this film science fiction. And I said, well, I have guns, the science fiction guns that go beep and look like plastic. They should be real. And he agreed. And I said, and I think my take on it is flying craft like should be like used cars where they get repaired all the time and they're dripping oil and they look real. And that was it. I got hired really within days. And we stuck to that philosophy. George's entire philosophy was nothing should ever look designed. Nothing should stand out ever. And I think we kind of achieved that. 2001 had its amazing kind of vision, the first one ever that took you into space. But, you know, that was standard kind of tape. Was everything was almost like airliners are, very, very clean and very pristine. But I don't think transport, Ridley always said to me when I first started, he said, I just want trucks in space. That's all I want. And I think that's why they related to audiences.
Just the number of films that have kind of used that flooring that is in Alien, you know, that kind of graded flooring and everything. And that lent so much to even just the tension of the film and the way that things were kind of dripping and going through from floor to floor.
Yeah, I think audiences felt they were there, that kind of claustrophobic, trapped inside something that's very real, especially in Alien. I think in Alien we really got it right, I feel, all the sets. Star Wars is an amazing kind of fantasy, and I've always supported these films because they're the true myths and legends that we need as human beings to help us learn who we are.
So you had been art directing for years before your Academy Award. How did you then kind of make the switch from that to directing?
Well, I'd always wanted to. That's in the end what I came in for. And the only way to get a job was in the art department. So I kind of worked my way through. And I'd got Life of Brian to co-design with Terry Gilliam. I'd applied at the National Film School for a directing course. And I got in. Life of Brian started before Alien, then fortunately for me it collapsed at that time, so Ridley within an hour had me down on Alien to get that news look that he wanted for the film. So immediately Alien ended, I was on a plane to Tunisia, and I came back late, and I went to the film school because I knew I had to. I'd seen other people say, oh, I'm going to direct, and they never did it. The next offer that came in, they thought, oh, you know what, I'm getting broke, I better take it. So I determined not to do that. So I tried film school. It was very difficult at that time. I should say 50% of the students had come in from schools and didn't really know what they wanted to do, so were just messing about. And it seemed like a good idea to them at the time. And a few serious people there. And I'd written Black Angel. I kind of hero worshipped Kurosawa, and I wanted to do a widescreen epic. And I couldn't make that at film school. I realized I was struggling to put the budgets together, and then it was just sheer accident. I was at the mix on Alien Learning, sitting there, and the head of Fox came, Sandy Lieberson, asked me what I was doing. I told him, and he said, give it to me. And I faxed it to him that night. He said, this is amazing. Can I fax this to George? Because he's ordered us to have a film made to go with Empire. And that was it. George came back and said, give him the, it was £25,000. It was nothing, but it was a government grant that they gave to the short film. And he said, I'll tie it to Empire Strikes Back, in which case they'll give me the grant. So that's what happened. I think it was about 500 prints made, because it was with Empire Strikes Back all over the world, wherever a 25-minute short program was shown with the main one. And that film really kicked me off. The Hollywood agent, who was Ridley's agent, and Robert De Niro's, picked me up based on that film. Based on that, I got a call from Ian Scorer, who was running a Paramount in the UK, and he said this government fund was ending and they wanted to go out with a bang, and he loved Black Angel so much that he said, would I make their last film and come up with an idea? And the producer and I searched long and hard for 3 weeks, and then on the day we met to decide what to make, an agent had sent a short story down that I read and said, we've got to make this. And that won an Academy Award as Best Dramatic Short Film. It's called The Dollar Bottom. And it was a wonderful story, just wonderful story set in Scotland. So we made that, and it got me going kind of on an independent path, but got me launched into then The Sender.
How was that transition of going from art direction to directing? Did you ever try to wear both hats, or were you pretty well-defined as far as, now I'm going to be in that director's chair, and when it comes to the other roles, I leave those to the people that I've hired?
It was difficult because I was really broke. I was broke, and the phone rang. I was eating brown rice. The phone rang, and it was Universal saying, we want you to co-design Conan. Ron Cobb's doing it, and he says he can't do it on his own. He was the illustrator for us on Alien, and he needs you with him. And I kept turning it down. Of course, the more I turned it down, the more money they offered me. It's that way it works. And I'm sitting there thinking, wow, all my troubles are over. All I've got to do is say yes. And I didn't. In the end, I stuck with it. And I would love to do it, because Milius is just an amazing writer and director. And I would have loved to have done it. But I thought, if I go back, then I'm back. I'm not coming out again. Ridley asked me to design Legend for him, which was even more tempting because he's a mate of mine. And I thought, well, that I could do and come out of it. But I just had to try and stick to what I was trying to do, difficult as it was. It wasn't easy at that time to get funding on anything. When I made The Sender, Tony Scott was making The Hunger, and we were both getting slammed and fired by our producers. And they kind of thought we were making European pictures, and we were being condemned for it. Tony got fired 3 times. I got 2. So began my kind of love affair with Hollywood, I guess.
Your next few films you wrote and directed. How was that? Because I know you had written and directed Black Angel. How was that kind of doing features after having done the shorts?
It's very difficult. And I prefer working with writers and then rewriting or going in on it. I like the process of other people giving me the ideas. I think there's, to me, it's a more interesting way to do it. And I'm kind of sticking that with now. But I often come up now with the ideas and then give it to really good writers, and then off they go. There's a natural symbiosis I find where I work with really good writers who with dialogue and characters and stuff, and then I can come in and just make it a bit more cinematic and a bit more commercially minded, if you like. You know, we all dream. I think all directors just want to write stuff and then make it, and it's deep from the heart. But it's tough. It's a very tough process. Sometimes that second voice is really valuable when you're coming and interpreting.
What were some of the ones where you kind of came up with the idea and then got to work with the writer to flesh it out?
Starship, which I kind of disowned afterwards because it had we were trying to make, Matthew Jacobs and I wanted to make a really irreverent kind of Western-like terrorist film, make it independently. And the sad thing was, and we got there, there was some really great stuff in, but halfway through, the financier pulled all his money out. We just struggled to finish it. And then it went dead. And then he sold the film. He bankrupted the company that made it. It was pretty rotten what he did. Bankrupted it, bought it back for $1, and then sold it to somebody else. And the film was not my film at all at the end. And it's really sad because Tony Banks of Genesis did the music for me, and it was awesome. And this guy took it off, and his uncle did the music. It was a bit stupid. So this kind of underneath, you can feel there's this irreverent kind of terrorist movie set in the future. We were trying to be a bit prophetic with it and do stuff that we thought would happen in these places.
The version that I have is just absolutely bizarre, where it goes from English to German all over the place.
German like my work. The Germans love it for some reasons. It's always my biggest kind of market. Because Nostradamus, that was one. I actually stopped making films for a while. I was just doing commercials in America. I missed a lot of my son's upbringing doing The Sender and things. So when my daughter was born, I just went off to America, lived there, and did commercials, which was kind of liberating. And then I got a call from a mate of mine. I'd done a New Age video with him, 20-minute kind of meditation video. He called me one morning. It was 10 o'clock in the morning. I remember it. He said, Roger, I'm going to make this musical with Boy George on the life of Nostradamus. You've got to do it. And I said, oh, yeah. Can I call you back? I need some tea. I went and thought about this, and I thought, you know what? This everyone in the world knows this name, but no one really knows about this man. And I knew something of it, and I remember looking him up in the then in the Encyclopedia Britannica. It was before Google. Scaliger, who was his mentor and taught him, was recognized as the second most intelligent man in the universe at that point, second only to Erasmus. And I thought, well, we're dealing with giants. So I'd looked at the story and I called him back and said, you know what, I got to make a film of this. And so he said, oh, okay, what do we do? And I found out that there were 12 scripts already written, and Orson Welles had been trying to do it. He never cracked how to tell the story. And so I worked out how to tell the story. I got a young writer who used to write my music videos for me, and I worked that out into a structure, and then got it watertight, and then sent him off to write it. Then he wrote the first draft, and then we got this very great German writer to come in and do the next draft. So that came from a seed of mine. That's the one I'm kind of most proud of, in a way.
I have to say that the cast for that is amazing.
Yeah, and we were in Romania less than a year after the revolution. There were shell holes in the inside all our hotels. There were cockroaches everywhere. There was no food in the country. The average wage was $1 a day for everybody in Romania. There was no restaurants open in Bucharest, not one that you could actually go into. There wasn't one. It was just closed. But it was medieval France. So I went in and made it there. And I phoned every actor before they came and said, listen, you can't come if you're going to complain about conditions, because there's no point, because this is it. There is nothing better. And they all came. Interestingly enough, the film went into the Spanish and French, both education systems, as the most accurate portrayal of medieval France there had been yet on film. And it's sad because the producer and I were doing an amazing story on, there was an American, two American and a British radio broadcasters doing the Nazi propaganda, who became the pop stars of their day through their voices. They were huge and amazing stories set in Nazi Germany. And we got up to within 3 weeks of shooting, and that one collapsed, but money fell out, which was a shame because it was so powerful. And Checky was cast, and then he fell out. And then I had Clive Owen before he became so big in the lead. There you go. You know, it threw us all for six, that one. So I had to kind of pick up the pieces again.
So I can't believe you went away from the Boy George musical version, though.
Yeah, I know. Funny things happen in life.
You went back to work with George Lucas as the second unit director on Phantom Menace. How was that?
Well, while I was waiting for the sender, Robert Watson George called me one day. They were doing Jedi. George was doing second unit to Richard Marquand, and then he was, I think, still kind of concerned about Empire. So he wanted to spend more time on the main unit. So they called me and said, what are you doing? I said, I'm waiting for the sender to trigger. And they said, well, can you wait 6 weeks? Can you come and take over second unit? So I did. And they said it would be uncredited because they promised it to the first, Dave Tomlin. I said, that's fine. And it's George's like family. So I actually did 5 or 6 weeks on Jedi with George. I knew George was directing again, and I was up mixing a film in Berkeley, and I went up to the ranch. They called me up to see them, and I went to say hello to Rick McCullum. I hadn't met him before, and George. And George was very complimentary to him, and he said to Rick, he said, there were truly only 4 people who stood by my side the entire time on Star Wars and got me through it, and that was Roger, John Barry, Les Dilley, and Norman, the art department. No one else really was with me. These were the 4 people. He never wavered. They said, come see us in Leeds. And I went to Leeds.
We're sorry, but we've run out of time. Be sure to listen to the rest of this episode at jackaloperadio.com in the Projection Booth archives. And be sure to leave your feedback at projection-booth.com. Stay classy.